Hello again, everybody, and welcome back to the Future, the podcast where we speak to the innovators of today, yes, who are making tomorrow happen. And making tomorrow happen with me this week are Free State's Adam Scott and Dave Waddell, who are co-authors of The Experience book, which, if you haven't guessed it already, is all about experience and how to design it, think it, and of course, make it. Adam, Dave, thank you for joining us.
Lovely to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Adam, I know that you founded the company, so Free State, but you're also a designer, an architect, a stonemason, and a teacher. So quite an interesting set of different, but I guess arguably interlocking jobs. Did that help you when you were conceiving Free State in the first place?
Well, yes, I think it did. I mean, you know, I suppose it's there in the title of the book, isn't it? For thinkers, designers, and makers. I mean, everything we'll probably talk to you about today is about that long relationship of things that are strategic and involve research, things that are then about design across all different channels, and then how you follow it through as a live and ever-evolving composition. And I think we're interested in those long relationships. We're interested in how all of those parts fit together. And even, you know, even the stonemasonry bit, which might seem like an anomaly there, you know, I was doing stonemasonry in between my architecture degrees because I wanted to be more hands-on. I wanted to be much more immediate. And I found that actually the respect for the love for the process that you have to have when you work stone, because it's so fantastically unforgiving, was actually rather useful when I started to better design things because I had more respect for the whole process.
The title of the book, you know, the experience, that big kind of thing that a lot of people are talking about at the moment. What does experience mean to you when you use that term?
So experience at a very basic level is everything. And neuroscientists and philosophers would, you know, have sort of grappled with the notion of experience for just about forever. In the world of neuroscience, it's pretty much agreed that experience is what we would call awareness. And awareness is how all living things, all living systems, humans included, sort of attend to both our own bodies and to the world outside and how our bodies move through space. However, we have also, in terms of developing consciousness, we are aware of that awareness. So we have this amazing capacity as humans to do this. We are planning animals. We have this a capacity to imagine our pasts, which we call memory. And some of our memory is dead on. It's 100%, you know, our recognition of faces. However, a lot of our memory is very scrappy, very bitty. And the idea is that this ability gives us this potential for foresight. And then within this potential for foresight, we have this ability, and I think this is critical to experience, is the counterfactual. We think many, many different scenarios before we make, which is not, you know, obviously not the whole thing, because we have to start making.
I mean, that was one of the bits that fascinated me about the book, because when I saw the title, The Experience Book, I was expecting it to be about just physical and making and designing experiences for, you know, corporate branding, entertainment, the drinks industry, etc. And what struck me as being quite brilliant about it, and to your point, it started with consciousness. It looked at memory, and then it used those things to remind us that by taking these into play, to your point, we can create the third option, which is the output or the foresight of what the thing could potentially look like. So, Adam, I'm just wondering if you can talk a bit more about what you both see as the hidden mechanisms that go to make up experience in the way that you're describing it.
Yeah, I think what we wanted to do is say, we look at now, as you say, Martin, all fields, whether it's the business of workplace or education or an airport or whatever it might be. And people are more and more talking about the value of the experience. But to your point, what on earth do we mean by that? And I think in very simple terms, which plays to what Dave was talking about this sort of storytelling animals, those experiences, when they're at their best, are very personal. They're episodic, you know, they're ever-changing, ever-growing, and they're deeply immersive. All channels of influence are alight to ensuring it's relevant and getting better and better and better. And in that way, we, you know, there is meaning. We connect with it. And in an ideal world, we don't just participate. We don't just transact. We want to take part. We want to make it our own. We want it to be formed and remade by our involvement. And I think that's the ideal, when it's highly participative rather than just being passive, and actually where we can then, you hand over the pen and you start to make it your own. That's what I think we love.
I was thinking about one of the case studies you mentioned in your book is about Dostoevsky, who is at the Kunstmuseum, I think, in Basel, and he sees Holbein's dead Christ. And you describe in the book, he is stunned, he is agitated, he is fearful, but also experiences a sense of mystical dread. Now, I kind of, that made me slightly shiver, because to me, that is what I expect from great literature, from great art, from great moments, that sense of, you know, being transformed. But what I thought was interesting is that one bit is what the designer, or the painter in this case, and I guess the museum architect, brings to that moment of transformation. And the other is the viewer or the participant themselves. But how do you orchestrate for a bit of the journey that you don't really know anything about what's in that person's head when they come to experience things?
In terms of the Dostoevsky, that's really interesting, because I think you're getting to the point about sort of planning for the unknown. Dostoevsky arriving at that museum on that particular day, the curator of the museum would never have known that he was coming. And even if the curator knew that Dostoevsky was coming with his wife, he would have never known the context in which this great man was arriving. He probably didn't know his backstory, and you'll know a bit about it, but he suffered a mock execution when he was very young. He spent 10 years in the gulag. He was a complete addict, a gambler. In many ways, the reason why he loved the Holbein picture is because he saw in Holbein and in the dead Christ, the fact that Christ was there painted in such a way, an extraordinary, extraordinary way that you wouldn't normally have seen from that era, where Christ has been literally trounced by nature. And Dostoevsky, seeing it, saw into Holbein's soul, if you like. The curator of the museum could never, never have designed for that. But however, there was a platform there, a rich platform for making this happen.
I mean, it's interesting you should say that, because I always say to people, when they talk about experience, they're usually quite mundane experiences. It's a pop-up food cart, or it's a piece of fairly anonymous, Sotonine art that has been commissioned by committee, usually developers who know very little to nothing about art anyway. So what you always end up doing is identifying the lowest common denominator and expecting that to deliver the highest revelation. And I think this is why I'm keen to really get into how people listening, the developers, the precinct owners, the placemakers, how they really need to come to terms with the fact that if they're going to do this in the way that you want the average punter to be affected in the, what I'm going to call the Dostoevsky fashion, what is it they need to do more of and do less of to really make this thing work in this transformative way we're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we need to let's reflect for a moment on what we're talking about here from the CEO's point of view, as you say. So let's say you are the CEO, let's say, of an airport, right? You are judged very harshly every moment by every one of those individuals who's going through your airport. The quality of that experience is the thing that makes people decide whether they're going to travel with you or not travel with you, or more importantly, whether they want to come 3 hours before and enjoy all the many offers and bring their family and friends on the landside bit of it, or they're going to rush through at the greatest speed. So all of these things, whether it's a traveler experience, student experience, customer, citizen experience, is the whole gig. It's the whole thing. And any CEO who doesn't care about their audience and their time well spent is clearly not serving their stakeholders very well. What we would say is what you need to be in the business of is strategizing, designing, and activating for all of the channels, right? So it's places and spaces, brand and identity, people and culture, tech and services, all working in concert. And if you can align those and guide those and optimize those, then you're going to spend far less money and be far more effective. But you can't be lazy. You've got to always be on. You can't leave it to each one of those silos to be distinct from each each other, they need to work in concert. And the greatest organizations in the world, whether they be Nike or Apple or Munich Airport or the city of Singapore, do this all the time. And it's hard work.
Yeah.
But that's what we're asking of these CEOs.
One of the things that occurred to me in the book, you speak quite a lot, really good case studies and examples. The 1984 Summer Olympics, which I think was a great Olympics that nobody wanted. It was a summer, it was Summer Olympics, and nobody wants that anyway, but essentially it was LA, bankrupt city. A second case study of Curtin University, which I'm familiar with in Australia, as somebody said, one of the most inclement and unwelcoming campuses found in the Southern Hemisphere. And then you've got, you know, King's Cross Development. And really, I just wanted you to talk through those three case studies in terms of the initial negatives that were that sat there, and then how they were converted to positives, and what were the levers used to convert those places or that moment, as it was at the Summer Olympics, to a more positive framework and sense of success.
So the Olympics, well, as you just alluded to, the Olympics was exactly what no self-respecting city wanted to have before 1984. Moscow tried it and nearly went bust. Montreal tried it 4 years before, and it took them 30 years to pay it back. There's all kinds of stuff going on, especially with Montreal, but it was a poison chalice. You wouldn't want it for anybody. And Los Angeles didn't want it because you'd end up paying, you know, for it for the next, two or three decades. So what they actually did was they started with a tiny, tiny, what you might call a steering group. This is the Olympic Committee. Really, really small. And they changed the governance or policy, both the Olympics did and so did Los Angeles, in order for Los Angeles to say they would not pay a cent for it and they wouldn't be made to pay a cent. So, and that was agreed right at the beginning. And the Olympics allowed for the first time to have kind of private money plowed into it. So all the buildings in Los Angeles that were used were basically either retrofitted or just rented. There's very, very few buildings that were actually built for the Olympics. So that kind of like plowing the money into infrastructure, it just wasn't there at all. So everything was built around exactly the kinds of things that Adam was talking about: tech and platform, people and culture, identity and brand, and spreading the idea of the Olympics across this vast Los Angeles space, in which at that time it was quite a divided city, and in lots of different places, it was really in a poor state. And they managed to sort of create this look and this feel using television, using some of the computers, using email, first use of email, and also using really, really good sort of tactics for wrapping the look and feel around the city. And it was just beautifully designed as well.
I think that thing about, again, words are losing meaning with every day. I mean, the word of purpose. I mean, with the LA 84 Olympics was incredibly clear-headed about its purpose, which was one about this coherent experience across every single touch point. And whether you're in the field of play, whether you're on the city street, whether you're in the stadium, that care for how it all came together was absolutely critical. And the fact that that seemed to be, as you say, man, it's such an extraordinary challenge, rallied everybody. It was the same with Curtin University. They were struggling, you know, as Andy Sharp, you know, the head of the States at the time, spoke of over 10 years ago. He was saying you could shoot a gun down any corridor and you wouldn't hit one person because there wasn't one student there. And so what they started doing was they started having every single element coming to life. And it wasn't just about pop-ups and graffiti and street art, even though they did do that. It wasn't just about having kind of entertainers and music and sound and life everywhere, even though they did that. The fact they were thinking about every single moment all of the time, they were designing with time, they were really walking in the shoes of their audience. They weren't thinking about it, whether it was in the terms of the alumni or in terms of the staff. They were obsessing about, you know, you're 17 years old, what's going to not just draw you to this place, but encouraging you to take part. And I think that ability to have the kind of humility that allows you to care for your audience as participants, and then to arrange every single element on their terms without getting distracted along the way by each and every designer. You know that phrase, if you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you speak to an architect about that challenge, they'll tell you they're going to build you a student hub and it will cost $1 billion. If you speak to a technologist about it, they'll say, we've got an app to ensure that everybody is going to spend every moment on site. Or a nutritionist, and they'll say they've got the perfect burger. What we're saying is you need to have all of these characters working together all the time. And that's why in some ways it's a live strategy. You don't fall in love with that purpose and identity. It's constantly evolving. And on the whole, designers and strategists are not taught like that. For them, it's too much a fixed obsession on the product rather than a care for the ever-evolving process.
Right. So I'm kind of getting that sense of somebody who's able to orchestrate, you know, like a great conductor, where they've got different instruments, different abilities, different skills in the orchestra, and they're trying to pull everything together. And I had a good example of this. I went to White City Place, which I think both of you are probably familiar with, probably one of London's better precincts. You know, it's got the Imperial College, Royal College, BBC Centre, ITV. It's got a biotech innovation hub. So I thought, in some ways, it's got all of the elements. It should make this precinct or the sector hum and feel that it was, you know, absolutely chocker with purpose. And when I got there, it was pretty mediocre. There were lots of empty spaces, lots of isolated silos, areas that people weren't using. I didn't feel there was a purpose or a creativity or a sense of culture over the long term. Because I always think we have the activation bit, which is everybody throws money at it. But really, it's like a spike in a long tail. If you don't keep the thing moving and constantly changing and new iterations of that, it tends to taper off. And you're probably doing it with a gamble or a hope that you bring in a big operator into a precinct or into you know, a retail neighborhood, and that they'll do the work for you. And then after that, you can quietly pull out and just let it get on. And as somebody said, over time, it will die if you're lucky. But if it survives, it becomes the most awful place that we have to visit or not visit in the city. So what do you think would be the long-term components I can pull in or need to consider on my checklist to make this thing happen properly over time?
Adam, let's talk around Songdo and Stockton on that and the difference between the two. So you've got, on the one hand, you've got the 40 billion city in a box with the sort of input-output strategy, just amazing, amazing sort of technology and all of that, and the end of mess. And then you've got Stockton on the other side, which for us is a champion a example of exactly what you're talking about, Martin.
I mean, in some ways, Martin, we're going to be total broken records here because, I mean, what we're talking about is, so Songdo is South Korea, is city in a box, as Dave says, and is the idea that essentially one can design the shit out of it from the very beginning. And that platform, essentially, people will love because it's so incredibly efficient and effective. All of those bits at Maslow's bottom of the pyramid are well done. However, there's nothing expressive about it if we're going further up the triangle. There's nothing that is encouraging participation. In no way is it restless. Is it always meanwhile? It doesn't really care whether you're there or not. And as a result, people are leaving in their droves. You know, those big businesses they wanted to attract, the businesses turn up, but actually the employees, the ideal, the extraordinary talent from around the world goes, I don't want to be there. I want to be in London or Melbourne or Sydney or Singapore. However, Stockton upon Tees is the absolute opposite. So the most extraordinary CEO, a man called Neil Schneider, over 15 years ago, he was somebody who saw that the big box retail out of town was killing his city centre. And so little by little, they started to think about, firstly, asking questions about what people wanted. It comes with the right questions. You know, what do you need? What do you want? What do you aspire to? And then from there, beginning to realize that it was going to be all about this narrative journey, this kind of a day well spent bouncing around the city center, you know, like a medieval kind of diagram, essentially, where it's just not just a high of retail on a high street, it's a high of all types. There will be healthcare here, there'll be leisure, there'll be education, there'll be entertainment, so much entertainment that on a Thursday and Friday nights, they close the whole of the high street, which is the widest in Britain, and they have events, they have dances, they have music, they have spectacle. And so he took the idea that they had a festival that was 1 week a year, and he festivalized the whole of his town. And so now, 16 years later, they have just purchased their shopping mall, two shopping malls, in fact, knocked one of them down, built a park, built a new connection to the river, and the richness demands that people want to spend time there. But it's root and branch. That is asking the right questions, understanding that ideal experience, and then following through with every touch point along a decade. And I know that's very hard for our audience to imagine that kind of root and branch thinking, but essentially that's what we're saying here. This experience thing is not the overlay. It is not the nice to have. It is the beating heart of how you differentiate and how you compete in this extraordinarily complex market.
So, Dave, just on that, I'm thinking, or rather what I'm hearing from Adam there, is that we still need a sense of a framework and a strategy that is live and has an ability to change constantly and to flex according to needs. But I know when I'm talking to a lot of CEOs and C-suites, they still have a nervousness about committing to anything where they can't see the journey or understand the pathway. And I'm kind of sensing that by laying out the thing too rigidly, we can end up in cul-de-sacs that we don't want. But by leaving it too flexible, we risk the CEO having a panic attack and, you know, not being able to answer whatever to the board. Is there a way to give us a framework that allows for these different components to move in the way they need to move, but a framework that is intelligible to the nervous CEO who maybe he, she, or they really just need reassurance when they sit with you? And if so, what does that framework look like?
Well, so let's begin with the first part and with strategy in and of itself. We start the chapter, as I think you know, we start the chapter with a slightly bombastic beginning. There's no such thing as strategy, and this is a chapter about it. And the idea is, and we take this from Lawrence Freeman, who wrote a giant tome on strategy. He says there is no point strategizing unless you've got, you know, uncertainty, instability, unpredictability. The big problem is that whenever we're being asked to do something, we think the first thing to do is to strategize. You know, and so strategizing by numbers is like coloring by numbers. It's not actually painting. It's not actually strategizing. So that would be the first point about that. You know, so when you're going to strategize, you can make sure that you are. And then also, you really, really do make space for the unknowns. You know, to come back to King's Cross, it's, you know, famous for a spatial master plan, which was a fifth blank, because they weren't sure what was going to happen. And if you think that's a kind of 17 to 20 year program, that's big bull stuff, right? To be able to leave a fifth of the spatial master plan completely blank, not quite knowing what's going to happen, and then to do an about turn and bringing in a college, whereas before it was going to be a workplace, as that kind of central piece to it all. And that was a dance. Adam had a chat with Roger Madlin about it, and it was just opportunist. So I think that, you know, in terms of that kind of framework that you're alluding to, the framework has to be loose. Stockton was incredibly loose in that sense. You have a battery of permissions, you have your outline of your plan, and you go to work. You start now and you start to build piecemeal across and around it. And you gather forces as you go.
And I think there's one more bit to your point, Martin and Dave, on that thing about that loose strategy and that framework we're looking for. You know, all those bits of the why of the top and then the middle of the how and the bottom of the what. What we often do with clients, and whether it's a student experience or traveler experience or workplace experience for Nike or whoever it is, above the line, we are obsessing on the narrative journey, the step-by-step, the day, the month, the year. We're interested in those many, many steps. You know, the airport, for instance, from home to landside to airside, every single step, and what people are needing, what they're wanting, what they're aspiring to, what they're thinking, what they're feeling. And then below the line, we look at then all of the different departments, places and spaces, brand and identity, tech and services. And we're looking at how they all play their part within this. So to your point, Martin, about the conducting, you need a dashboard to help you understand and be able to hear your, not just your you know, the 53 people within your orchestra, but also how the 1,000 within the audience are. And that is what we try and do. We try and make it live, this framework, as much as possible.
Wow. I'm seeing this shape or this master plan that you have carefully laid out. And I'm just wondering, and I guess it's something you have learned from ongoing live experiences. And I just wanted to get to that point where normally at this point in the show, I say, look, let's look back. Knowing what we know now, this is why it's called Back to the Future. Knowing what we know now, is there an activity or a point or a project where you think, wow, if I was to do this again, I would do it so much differently or completely from a different perspective? Or are you always happy? Are you happy where you are now saying, actually, I've done what I've done and it's fine. I don't need to jump into my, well, I do a DeLorean, but I think you prefer the telephone box from Bill and Ted. I think in the source book part of the experience book, you mentioned the Bill and Ted telephone box. I'm going to give you that. Travel back in time. You're going to look at a project and go, wow, okay, I'm going to recalibrate, do it differently, get it back into the future.
Yeah. As you know, Martin, I was a teacher for 16 years before I then set up a copywriting company and worked in the world of whiskey. I was a taster. In all of that time, when I left the teaching, I was in sort of the orbit of Free State, and eventually sort of I now actually am employed by the company. However, my first big project as an adult was actually, you know, the classroom. And I used to spend an enormous amount of time, as much time as I spent on whatever the curriculum was for that term, I would also spend on designing the learning experience within the classroom. So, and if you like, I had 32 to sometimes 36 clients. I used to make sure that everybody was participating. They had their jobs and so on. So it was, I felt it was a really rich place to be. It never started like that, by the way. I was, as everybody else, when I was starting out teaching,
yeah.
You know, I wasn't the best of teachers. By the end, I felt like I was okay. But looking back now, I realized that there was one huge element missing. I was the designer. I was God. I was playing God. I wasn't allowing the 32 other people in that classroom to design their own environment. I think that's what I have learned, you know, that kind of to loosen up, to bring the community in, and that community, those young people who have incredible ideas, who have incredible potential, who have, you know, this is where they are most of the time during, you know, during their year. And this is their environment. And I don't think I gave them enough to do that.
So it is more about the collaborative, I guess, co-creative, co-iterative moment, which I think is a really good, well, I mean, it is an excellent learning now for most businesses, because they tend to still work in that hierarchy rather in that sort of way of collaborating and allowing people to make inputs. It sounds like your business is doing that from what you've both described. It sounds like this is how you work within businesses. And I'm just wondering, Adam, was there a particular time when you came across something that really changed how you would do things in future? Like just a moment that you go, wow, this is completely wrong. I need to relook at, redo, rebuild differently.
Yeah, we did a terrible project in the early 2000s where I thought Photoshop was real. And I remember we did all these lovely images and I just thought they were real. And then we tried to build it like that. And it was this mist, light and sound installation powered by a wind farm scale windmill. And of course, you know, it looked great in Photoshop, but actually in reality, it was very wet and miserable and terrifying. And people hated it. And what I learned from that is we sort of fell in love with the sort of background, the image of the thing. We weren't thinking nearly enough about how we were going to draw people in, the mid-ground and the foreground bits. We hadn't baked in the idea that as it opened at day one, was not the most important thing, that day 1001 was what it was all about, and it needed to get better with time once it knew its audience. And so I suppose that was a real turning point, that I realized, yeah, we need to be thinking much more programmatically, much more humbly, and we need to bake in the money and the team, the back of house, the operations, the OPEX, to ensure that we can really supercharge this thing from day one onwards.
Okay. I'm just aware that we've come pretty much to the end of our time together, but I'm going to give you both last words, potentially, although I will add some of my own last words into it. But if I ask you, now that we've had a chat about experience, what would your last advice or piece of advice to be on experience to people listening? What is the one thing that you think they should think about? What experience means and should be considered, or they should consider about it in the future?
Well, two things, and one is so obvious, and it's what we learned during the extraordinary social experiment that was COVID. Whatever we think of a particular design, however pleased we are with it, however majestic it seems, it is nothing without people there. It is absolutely nothing. And we just to walk Soho during first lockdown, with all those buildings, with all that history, with all that so-called rich, rich past and everything it talked to us about, it was silent, absolutely silent. It was zombie land during, if there's nobody there. So, I mean, that's a very obvious one. And then the other thing is that, you know, our capacity for putting ideas into the world comes with great responsibility. And we talk about the death camp in the book as the most sort of terrible example of design, an experience of design in which you are either going to be exterminated instantly when you arrive, or you're going to be exterminated through work. That is a very, very bad idea thrown into the world. And I think that, you know, we have a great responsibility, and you can see with the world now and where we are now in terms of everything, we really have to think carefully about our power to design experiences.
Well, I think somebody did describe that, you know, the whole issue of Nazi Germany. He said it was the aesthetification of fear. Mm. You know, we forget how much the thing was orchestrated, but I kind of feel a lot of people tend to overlook these things when they're seeing experiences always about joyous, great, pleasurable. To your point, there is a darker side to it. I mean, Adam, just in the final moments, was there one thing that you felt people should kind of take away when they talk about experience?
I think the design experience is our secret sauce. You know, for 35,000 years, this has forged connections with the tribe, helped us build our identity. This is the thing that helps us prevail over all manner of challenges ahead of us. And so we need to think about it not as the overlay, but the underlay. It needs to be the thing that powers everything we do, and do it very intentionally. And as Dave says, or you say, it can be a terrible thing, but often it's a terrible thing because it's overlooked. We're just asking people to be much more intentional about the way they think about it, and to be constantly measuring so that they can constantly improve. And in this way, we'll attract people back to our cities, and we'll be able to, I think, you know, better rejoice in a congregational society rather than one that's ever more atomized.
Well, I'm quite liking the idea of a congregational society, given that I think it has become increasingly fragmented and distance. And I think, you know, the one thing I learned from the book is how through experience we can bring people back together again. Because I think that's one of the big, you know, debates, challenges, questions is how do we get people back to X or Y? And I'm thinking, well, the question you're asking is the wrong one. The question is, why would they want to bother? And I think the book really brings out a lot of the reasons why, particularly the back section, which I think is called your source book, which gave me so many new ideas of what I should be thinking about the city and placemaking. So many thanks for speaking to me today. The book is called The Experience Book. It's for designers, thinkers, and makers. I guess I can get it on Amazon, but I would advise people to go to good independent bookshops and enjoy the experience while they're doing it. That's all for me. My name is Martin Raymond. Until next time, as always, keep looking, keep listening, keep learning, and keep asking what's new and what's next.
Thanks, Martin.
Thank you, Martin.